Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Lady Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and today I'm joined by Chris Hutting. Let's get into the first news story today, and this is about the position of the IFP with regards to how it views the MK party and also potential coalitions with the ANC and MK. So there's been a lot of speculation about the IFP because the IFP has traditionally been, shall we say, a little bit erratic in its behavior sometimes. You never really know whether it's going to side with the opposition or whether it's going to side the ANC. We've seen over the years, over the last 10 years, kind of the IFP going both ways at different times. It's sometimes been willing to work with the ANC, but it's also sometimes been very willing to work with the opposition, as it is in many places in KZN now, particularly with parties like the DA, but also other ones as well. Addressing the Cape Town Press Club, Vilenkosi Hlabisa, the leader of the IFP, said that he wasn't too worried about how the party would fare against the new MK party. He said, regarding the MK, we are not threatened at all. The people of KwaZulu-Natal know who Jacob Zuma is. He did 9 years as the president of our country. They know the damage he did. It is only ANC members who are disgruntled, who were moved from supporting the ANC to support Zuma because of the anger among them. In terms of being a threat, not at all. We are just waiting to see with the launch of the manifesto and the magnitude of their support, because otherwise we just hear sound and noise. He said his party was also not completely keen on working with either the ANC or the MK in terms of coalitions, which are very likely to be the case in both KZN and possibly even nationally, if national polls are to be believed. He said that a coalition with the ANC, working with them would be the hardest decision one would have to make. Quote, it would be difficult to work with the ANC because the ANC destroyed the country. If you want to fix South Africa, you cannot fix it with the people who destroyed it. The IFP is open to working with a number of political parties across the spectrum as long as we share a common direction. Obviously, it will be difficult to work with a political party whose condition is the nationalization of mines, nationalization of banks, or pure socialism. It would be difficult because we believe in a free market economy. Socialism has proven itself to be a failure throughout the world, he said. So I think this is a pretty clarifying statement from the IFP leader. It does suggest that they are very much at least concerned that voters might associate them as possibly going into some sort of deal with the ANC and MK. We'll have to see how they, he, of course, didn't rule it out completely here, but we will have to see how things go when the lure of power and prestige arrives after the election, because all political parties, whether it's the IFP, whether it's the DA, whether it's the EFF, no matter what their strategic goals and objectives and priorities are, it's going to be very difficult for them to resist that temptation to go into coalition government with the ANC, whether that's on a provincial level or on the national level. Chris, what do you make of this story? I think that this is probably very good news for the multi-party charter, as the IFP is very likely to be the second biggest party in the multi-party charter after the DA. Do you think that the IFP will hold this stance?
Yeah, a few things. So number one, even though the ANC looks to be on the decline, we'll see how quickly that decline is accelerated or not, if it's just below 50 or below 40, even as some polls seem to indicate, it's still going to be the sort of central force around which others rotate in some form or fashion. Whether they can work well enough together in something like the MPC to shift even more of that gravity away from the central force that is the ANC, that remains to be seen. There have been questions, not only around the IFP, but some other parties about their core principles, where do they stand on certain core issues. Once they get into some sort of coalition, if that happens after the elections, what are the requirements of that coalition? Is it around positions in departments or cabinet? Is it around principles? So things like expropriation, prescribed assets, the NHI, where are the lines in the sand? And if it is a line in the sand, of course, it can be kicked away or shifted quite easily. So that's one thing to keep in mind. And then secondly, just on the IFP specifically, you mentioned at the start, sort of your quote, the few quotes there from their leader, Hlabisa, talking about, you know, we know MK and we're not worried about MK. So I'm paraphrasing. But to me, that almost betrays a little bit of a psychological point, where if you're talking about it so much and acknowledging it, are you really not worried, or are you worried that you're trying to, you know, sort of talk about the elephant in the room? So I worry a bit about what exactly is at play here, where they realize how much MK could hurt them, especially in in KZN, where Zuma remains quite popular and could exploit the frustrations with Ramaphosa and the ANC, where people might not have voted or they might then vote for the EFF as a protest vote. They're not happy, so now they're going to shift to MK to try and rescue the ANC, as it were. So to hear quotes such as that gives one confidence and hope in the IFP, especially from a sort of liberal perspective around things like the free market, property rights, all that sort of thing. But you have to see what actions follow based on that. So a good sign and a good path forward. But as always, with maybe those more inclined to our point of view, don't get too excited just yet. See what proof is there in the pudding, maybe.
So it's very difficult to tell how MK and the IFP will affect each other in the election so far. We've had a couple of by-elections. I think it's literally only two by-elections where they have been both competing against each other. And the IFP seemed to lose some of its votes to MK, but the ANC definitely suffered more. So I think Tlhabiso may be quite correct there when he says that the ANC has more to fear from MK than his party does. We've also seen that in the provincial polling, the IFP, this is from the Social Research Foundation polling, it suggests that the IFP and ANC might be relatively close together, somewhere in the 20s in KZN, with MK being the largest party, around 30%. Now, it's difficult to tell, you know, whether this is going to be the final result on election day, but that suggests that the IFP still has some room to grow in this election in KZN, whereas the ANC seems to be the one most hemorrhaging from MK. But like I said, there's precious little data, so it's actually very difficult to confirm whether indeed that might be the case. We may have to wait for election day, or maybe perhaps some more polling before we can make any definitive calls on that one. But something very interesting to watch, because the IFP is going to be a key part, I think, of any multi-party charter, possibly in KZN and maybe Gauteng and nationally as well, even. So we'll have to keep an eye on that. Okay, let's move on to our next story. And this is one of those kind of tragic stories which is symbolic of so much going wrong in South Africa. And this is in Tswane, around the area of Mamelodi. There's a squatter camp called the Nkandla Informal Settlement. And there is a gang who have called themselves Boko Haram, naming themselves after the terrorist group in Nigeria, who are apparently terrorizing people who want to get water. There is relatively little access to water in the area. And so the municipality sends water trucks often to go and ensure that people still have a supply of drinking water. However, many of the residents who are afraid to give their name to the media have told Ground Up that they are constantly threatened by the Boko Haram gang, forced to pay large sums of money, at least relative to their total income, for this water. That in particular, small businesses like taverns and spaza shops and shabins are the worst hit when it comes to having money extorted out of them. And this water is supposed to be given freely by the municipality. Essentially, the gangs are hijacking it. Also, there's some accusations by the people living in this area that it is the water tanker staff themselves, in some cases, who are trying to extort money from people collecting water. One man who was interviewed by Ground Up said that he has to survive on about 25 liters of water a week, which is basically one very large bucket. He says, "I bath, cook, and wash dishes with that one bucket." So, Chris, this is not uncommon. We've seen these kind of gangs seizing control of infrastructure, of economic projects and stuff all over the country. Everything from sort of high-end construction projects where you have fairly sophisticated advanced gangs, illegal mining, but even the poorest of the poor are being hit by gang stuff like this, where you can't even get water from a municipal truck without being threatened at gunpoint if you don't pay. What do you make of this story?
Now, this might be jumping a bit too far into the philosophy and all that sort of thing, but if your state, which is supposed to have your monopoly on force, no longer uses that or employs that, then you're going to have different things filling the void. So in this particular example, this is a negative actors. These are negative actors who are filling that void and taking up that space. Now, this is very basic service provision, service delivery, that function not being fulfilled by your state. But of course, the state doesn't have the capacity to prevent others from providing that service, or indeed stepping in when that is abused or misused in any particular way. So as much as I think the decline of your sort of central authority has been good in the last while, because people are finding alternative solutions and they're reducing their dependence on the state, on the flip side, you have the possibility for negative actors to fill that void. So your mafias, people like, such as these, who can then exploit those people in society with very few resources, who are just dependent on whoever might be quote unquote wielding the biggest stick. And then they just are sort of at their mercy in that particular situation. So it remains to be seen how these sorts of things can be solved. Again, I don't think it's going to be solved from Pretoria, for example, from your central authority. So what other, how can communities better set themselves up to not be taken advantage of in this particular way, to ensure that those resources within their purview, they're managing well, they're protecting well, they're upgrading, they're maintaining, all that kind of thing. I think it requires a multi-layered, multi-pronged approach. It might be different in one community versus another across the country, which is both an exciting but also very intimidating state of affairs. So I think for the time being, at least over the next 5 years, we're going to see this sort of situation manifest in various different ways. That's how, that seems to be the trend line for South Africa broadly, where your central authority is failing in many different ways, and it's either going to be filled by positive or negative forces.
Exactly. I think this is yet another example of how the collapse of the police service as being an effective force in society has really hurt absolutely everyone in society, from the rich to the poor. It's the police service is in urgent need of reform and repair in order to get government functioning again properly. Okay, let's move on to our last story for today, and this is about South Africa's millionaires. We talk about millionaires in terms of US dollars. So in other words, people with kind of a net worth of more than 20 million rand or so. And a report by Henley & Partners, which is an annual Africa wealth report, looks at which cities across the African continent have the highest number of US dollar millionaires. Johannesburg led the way with about 12,300. Cape Town follows with 7,400. Cairo with 7,200. Nairobi with 4,400. And Lagos with 4,200. However, there has been some very significant growth in places like Cape Town, South Africa's Whale Coast, Kigali, Windhoek, other places in Namibia, Nairobi, Tangier, and Marrakesh in Morocco. The interesting thing in this report, though, is the prediction that it makes about the city of Cape Town, which is that by 2030, in terms of millionaires, it will overtake Johannesburg in 2030. And in fact, this particular company tends to move its offices from Johannesburg to Cape Town on that front. There's also a significant growth of millionaires living in places like the Garden Route, where the millionaire population has gone up 38% in the last decade. Now, we're talking about relatively small groups of people here, right? You know, in South Africa, we're talking about maybe less than 25,000 people in total who fall into this millionaire category. But it is, I think, indicative of the way that Johannesburg in particular is seeing such incredible decline in services at the moment. There was the Johannesburg Water Business Plan was written up by, there was some reporting done on it by News 24, which suggests that the city of Johannesburg is headed for a catastrophic collapse of its water infrastructure due to underspending and mismanagement that goes back many years, but has worsened in the last couple of years. Chris, what do you make of this? I mean, this could, if this report predictions hold, we could really see the South African economic center slowly shifting away from Johannesburg over the next decade or so.
Indeed, and it's when you're sort of in the maelstrom of events and lots of change, and we've got the elections, and then you lose sight of over time how trends develop. So that's not to say that the sort of thing happens, you know, from the Sunday to the Monday of a given week, you lose all your millionaires in a given city. But these things happen over time, and capital, much like I think how water flows, flows along the path of least resistance. If you make it more difficult for businesses to start, small to medium businesses, for big corporates to function through things like service delivery failure, never mind the macro policy environment in South Africa. So again, flirting with things like expropriation without compensation, more tighter BEE regulation, more punitive in that sense, the NHI, all those things then in turn make it more difficult for capital to form and flow into South Africa. Then it might head to other emerging markets, places like Brazil or India. I mean, India's growth rate, I think the IMF has it around 6.8% for 2024. It's quite a remarkable story overtaking China in that regard with its growth prospect. So for Joburg and Cape Town, it's not to say that the Western Cape and Cape Town will have all the answers 24/7, all the solutions, but you sort of weigh up, where is your business going to do better? Where will you get, on average, better return on investment? No, nowhere is guaranteed. But you as a millionaire, for example, you want your money to do the work for you. There's the assumption that, you know, millionaires and billionaires, their money just sits off somewhere in sort of a bank vault. But the point is they've got assets, they've got investments. That in turn, those assets, those investments, the interest on those, the capital wins on those are used to fund new businesses and new ventures, entrepreneurship, a sense of dynamism and activity. When your given city or your country loses those individuals and those businesses, I think generally your economic complexity declines. And for all the, you know, this is a bugbear of mine, but I'll finish with this. For all your localization master plans, your plans of spurring local manufacturing and growth, if you don't have those that wider supporting network in place, your basics like service delivery, then you're just going to pump subsidies into individuals and businesses that don't succeed over time, that can't compete. And this will be the case, I think, for Johannesburg if it doesn't get its own house in order. It's not due to anyone else's choices except city council. You can talk about things like COVID, global economic downturns. Those happen to every country. Every country is affected by those. But you can put yourself in a stronger position going forward if you make it easier for businesses to start up in your given city, I think.
Definitely. And of course, it is those millionaires who are the most able to absorb the negative costs of dysfunction in the municipality. And so when you see them leaving for somewhere else, in part because they don't like the way that things are going around them, just imagine the sort of middle classes and even some of the more mobile poor who will immediately also probably follow them, trying to escape those same problems. All right, that's all the time we have for today. We hope you found the show interesting. That's a wrap.